I'm Jonathan Bastian. This week on KCRW's Life Examined, climate-induced migration. It's already happening elsewhere on the planet, and the data indicates roughly 50% of all Americans will be uprooted.
About 160 million Americans might be shifting into marginal zones in terms of climate, and the niche is moving from the middle part of the country northward, closer to the Great Lakes in the upper Midwest. And if we have a really worst-case climate warming scenario, that niche is going to shift right over the border.
And later, from scientist to activist, and what it took to transition.
I could see roots dying, and it was heartbreaking. I've seen tons of graphs. I've read tons of papers in the IPCC report. You spend enough hours in a place, develop a connection to those organisms, and to watch them die is heartbreaking.
On the Move, the data and science of climate migration, and why one Earth scientist left her lab to sound the alarm. That's coming up on Life Examined. Last week, we took a look at some of the driving forces behind immigration, the challenges at the southern border, and what it means to belong to a place. This week, how an increasingly warming climate is already having a major impact on migratory patterns around the globe and in the U.S. And later, why abandon an established career to become an activist? We'll hear what drove one Earth scientist to make that choice. But first, from the Great Migration to the Dust Bowl, Americans have had a long and ongoing history with human migration. And if current projections hold steady, billions of people will migrate northwards due to overheating of the planet and many ancillary effects that we'll have. These types of dire predictions often go unnoticed. Charts, graphs, and reports don't tug at the heartstrings. But investigative journalist Abram Lustgarten says the charts and data tell a much more compelling story. Americans are already packing up, and American society is already slowly transforming. Abram Lustgarten is the author of On the Move, The Overheating Earth and the Uprooting of America, and he joins me now. Welcome.
Hi there. Thanks so much for having me.
I want to talk about this idea that humans, it seems, have always been part of some type of a migratory pattern, whether it's been climate-related, which is something we think of as a very new part of our story, and no doubt part of it is. But I wonder if you could remind us just how humans have always shifted, even from our, you know, earliest ancestors, that it's very much a part of the human story that we've always talked about and looked at.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, people have always moved around the planet. That's how we have come to be located around the planet, out of Central Africa. And many of those migrations from, you know, the beginning of human time have also been environmentally driven. You know, people moving off of Africa 90,000 years ago in response to drought, civilization, you know, shifting across the continents and even into down to Australia and across Indonesia and over across the Bering Strait into North America. And in more modern times, Americans have migrated. We didn't always populate the southwestern and western parts of this country, but we have, you know, gradually settled, and those populations have increased dramatically, even since the 1950s, in a form that we could call migration, as well as other past migrations in the United States. The Great Migration out of the South of blacks after the end of slavery has the greatest transformations in this country's, you know, cultural history.
Yeah. I also think about the Dust Bowl, which is maybe, would you say, almost the closest parallel we have, in a sense, to the modern climate crisis we're dealing with? Again, you know, the Dust Bowl being, in a sense, a very man-made problem that resulted in catastrophic weather conditions and a massive migration to California.
Yeah, absolutely. The Dust Bowl doesn't match what we're seeing now in terms of scale. The Great Migration is closer, but the Dust Bowl is our, our closest analog to dramatic environmental change that forced people to change where they live. And you're right, it was largely caused by human folly, by mismanagement of those lands that then collided with, you know, an epic drought and forced 2 to 4 million people out of the Great Plains. And many of them came to California. And again, their arrival in California, while it wasn't easy or smooth at first, it's now so much a part of the identity of the state. It transformed the state's culture in the Central Valley, and cities like Bakersfield and places like Salinas wouldn't be what they are today without those millions of people.
Let's take a look at, I think, this incredible data set that you've been working through. I mean, this book came out of a series of articles, I remember, almost 3, 4, or 5 years ago now. And I'm curious, just what you have been looking at in terms of numbers, facts, figures, projections, in terms of why we might be headed towards this next massive migration.
Yeah, I mean, just to kind of back up to the beginning for a second, I mean, my reporting started with a look at climate migration globally, and very large numbers of people would shift around continents, and it's inspired in part by a body of research that looks at what they call the human habitability niche, and it's this idea that there's for 6,000 years been a niche that humans survive best in, and that niche is moving and it's shifting northward towards the poles. And it basically projects that billions of people across the equatorial regions of the planet will be displaced from ideal habitat and that they might have to move in response to that. And so two things happened to me. I mean, I live in California, and while I was doing this reporting, we were fending off a couple of really terrible wildfire seasons that were both a physical threat and a huge inconvenience in terms of blankets of smoke lying over the state for months at a time. And so it really got me thinking about what climate migration might mean for the United States and how I might, have to consider moving in response to climatic change. And then I looked at that original study, that human habitability niche, and worked with the researchers to try to figure out what that meant specifically for North America, because it wasn't a part of their study. In really general terms, it suggests that about half of Americans, about 160 million Americans, might be, shifting into marginal zones, not completely uninhabitable zones, but marginal zones in terms of climate, and that the niche is moving from the middle part of the country northward, closer to the Great Lakes and the upper Midwest. And if we have a really disastrous kind of worst case climate warming scenario, that ideal niche is going to shift right over the border into southern Canada.
What are the numbers in terms of when this migration could occur? Is it now? Is it in 10 years, 20 years? What are the facts that we know there, or the projections?
Think we're talking about a really slow-moving change. It's starting now, and we could talk about, ways in which Americans are already displaced or are already moving. But I describe that as really a trickle. And I think that the large-scale, migratory effect is something we'll look back on a couple of decades from now and be able to see more clearly as it's taken shape. But it's really hard to perceive now. The kind of research I was just describing frames the time frame as, 2050 to 2070. There's another set of data that I used to get really specific and granular in the United States, and that looked at specific risks on a county-by-county level across the country. And the time frame for those risks is as soon as 2040. I really tried to bring this analysis forward into something that was immediate and less theoretical. And so we start to see things like, according to that data, declining crop yields, increasing wildfire risk, dramatic sea level rise and flooding on the coast, all within the next 16 years or so. We can't pinpoint who will move, how many people will move, but those are things that are expected to directly drive migration.
Yeah, and it's interesting just to think about where we are right now. And I admit I live in a bubble of, California, Colorado, but on the day-to-day level, anecdotally, I don't hear of anybody moving and saying the reason is climate. Or I go to the food store and there's all the vegetables and fruits of all seasons still available, in plentiful amounts. And so, I think it's hard for us on the day-to-day level, depending on where we live, at least, to acknowledge that there could be the beginning of a migratory pattern shift, or that things really are different. And I think this also ties into the fact that sometimes, climate change can feel hard to see, depending on where you are, or when there is a fire. I don't know how it is, but we tend to forget about it unless we were directly impacted by it. So just kind of curious to get your thoughts on the fact that sometimes on the day-to-day level, this stuff doesn't seem very clear to us.
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends on where you live, and
Yeah.
also, that you have to look for it to see these signals now. But if you live in southern Louisiana, for example, climate migration is well underway, and it has been for a couple of decades. And that was one, focus area of my research. We have dramatic land subsidence and fairly dramatic sea level rise already along the coast of Louisiana. Lost something like 2,000 square miles of land And that loss of land has shifted where people live. Since Hurricane Katrina in 2005, the populations of just about every parish south of the city along the coast has dramatically declined, some by upward of 40%. And people continue to leave. And there's been organized government structured retreat programs, resettlement programs for entire communities. So that is a type of climate migration that is well underway. And then, more anecdotally, my inbox, because I've been covering this for a couple of years, is flooded with messages from people, and has been for years, who are either thinking about moving or want to share the story of why they moved from Florida to Michigan, for example. So there, it's very, very difficult to measure. There's no good data, but there's anecdotal evidence that this is beginning to happen.
Here's just a theory that I was thinking about before we spoke today, as I was just trying to think about different parts of the country and have a little bit of knowledge here. But like, I wonder if the people that this is going to impact are almost the ultra wealthy that live along something like the California coastline, that are going to fight to keep their houses or sell them, or people that are really poor, let's say, in southern Louisiana. Like, who do you think this is going to impact? Because it seems that the coastal regions have become quite elite, but they're not always elite, you've just reminded me. So, like, where do you see the impact happening socioeconomically?
Yeah, that's an insightful question, and you're right. It really striates along economic lines. The most mobile mobility is proportional to to wealth and means, and so the most mobile among us will be the middle to upper middle class and younger families. Right, so these are people who have economic incentives to seek stability or new opportunity elsewhere, and the energy and perhaps ambition to take on that kind of move. The ultra wealthy will be undoubtedly the most protected from all of the kinds of change that we're seeing, but they'll also be perhaps the most stubborn, or I mean, these are families that might be able to afford to hold property in Vermont while they continue to live in California, for example, and they can kind of have, a foot in both places, or afford to make their properties or their, hard infrastructure more resilient and more protected. And then at the other end of the spectrum, unfortunately, we can expect that poor and underprivileged and often minority communities are going to bear the brunt of much of this change. They are already disproportionately affected because of decades of legacy inequalities that actually make them more vulnerable to climate change. But then they'll have less, ability to adapt and to move. And when they remain in place, they'll also have, less resources to, to cope and evolve with the change that's happening in the places where they might remain.
It's interesting to think about how cities were laid out among really, I think, devastating socioeconomic terms or lines. New Orleans is a very famous example, but it seems to be almost everywhere. And this is just my noticing, right? That people that had more means would build up on slightly higher ground or on hills in natural towns. I mean, you see it everywhere almost, unless it's kind of wealthy coastal areas. But then you have something like New Orleans, right, and the Ninth Ward, which is more or less built underwater and populated by the poorest people. Do you find that to be true, and one reason that these are populations that will be impacted so heavily?
Yeah, that's true. Coastline settlement is a is a funny thing, full of contradictions. But one focus of my reporting is on parts of rural coastal Maryland, and it's an area where, unlike Florida, right, where the rich have flocked to the coastline and built mega mansions, these parts of Maryland, were settled by, well, first of all, they were original black communities. The arrival of the first slave ships from Africa landed, on these parts of Maryland. But they were also places that, in the Reconstruction era, where freed blacks moved back to, to build families and to build their own farms. And they did that, as you suggest, in some of the most marginal low-lying coastal areas, because even then they were a little less desirable. The wealthier estates remained on that slightly higher ground. And so, the pile-on effect of that now is that obviously those low-lying coastal areas are even more low-lying today, and they are more in jeopardy. But we see that in a whole host of different ways too. The legacy of redlining, for example, in our cities. And I looked closely at Los Angeles, for example. But we had discriminatory housing policies that had a long-term effect of, concentrating minority and Black communities in areas that then received less investment and where home values rose more slowly. And among a long list of problems, what we see in those communities today is that they're hotter. In Los Angeles, they're 10 degrees hotter than white communities that have more tree coverage and more parks and more grass. And they've received less investment. So they don't have, for example, the flood drainage infrastructure or other types of infrastructure that make them more resilient. So when climate catastrophes come, those same neighborhoods are not only hotter, have more health effects because of the heat, but then literally sustain greater disasters.
That's really, sad and interesting. Can you talk about the parts, let's just say, of America that are growing the fastest because of other migratory patterns? And I would just always hear of things like, oh, Houston as these fast-growing cities, or Atlanta, but they seem to be like big southern areas or parts of Texas. And in my mind, those are the places that are going to get walloped by climate change and eventually have to deal with migratory patterns. So where do you see the country filling in, and is that good or bad for this story?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. You asked about the time scale, and one of the things that I think we see in the near time scale is a lot of mixed messages and trends crossing and contradicting each other. And so, the reality is today that 9 of the 10 fastest growing regions in the country are among those that my maps and data suggest are the most at risk, along the South and in the Southwest. And Phoenix continues to be, one of the fastest growing cities in the country, as does Houston. And, Florida has grown immensely over the last decade, as has Atlanta. So there's a couple of things going on, but big picture, what my data and the patterns that I think I've identified suggest is not that those whole regions will empty out, that like Houston will one day be a ghost town, that it might actually be the opposite, that that rural areas will find themselves less supported, in a hotter future, and that people will leave rural areas towards cities. We see rapid patterns of urbanization, and so it might be that West Texas moves to Houston, and Houston continues to grow, and that rural Arizona, all moves into Phoenix, and Phoenix continues to grow, and that those cities will have the tax base and the infrastructure and the communities to build some resilience and to protect more of the people who move there, while more rural areas empty out.
Which seems to me so counterintuitive. You mentioned the urban heat island effect. Cities tend to bake unless they're planned properly. And what does that mean? Are you better attached to a grid that can afford you AC or just stable housing or jobs? I don't know. What is it?
Yeah, it's all of those things, but I don't know that when people make a decision, to move, that they're thinking about, what's the relative heat island effect in the place that they go. And also, cities which are adapting for the future will need to improve their heat island effect, and address that problem kind of separately. But the pattern, going back to historical migration, around the world, always has been and will continue to be that, people move the shortest distance possible. I see this in my research in Guatemala. People are likely to, when they leave small villages in the mountains, they're not moving directly to the United States. They ultimately end up in the United States. First, they're going to, the larger town, and they're having a go at it there, and then they're moving to Guatemala City, and then they kind of stepwise, move up from there. And so, that explains a little bit of the pattern, in the United States too, where Atlanta, even as a southern city, might see enormous growth as other parts of the southeastern, United States migrate northward, Florida or from the coast of Georgia. You know, and there's all of these layers of patterns and reasoning. And so, you know, heat island effect or things like that, I think they, you know, probably fall down further down the list of priorities when, you know, when those decisions are being made.
Can you talk about food security issues? This is something that I don't think we talk about a lot. I mean, Michael Pollan was on the show and he's trying to raise this red flag, but I mean, it really does surprise me. You know, I shared earlier, you go to the grocery store and you see every fruit and vegetable of every season being presented all the time. We know that aquifers are being drained around the country, which is something that's been happening in California for a long time that's been reported on. But this to me seems like the scariest thing that doesn't get a lot of coverage. But what do you see in terms of food security moving forward?
I see our food systems changing dramatically and the geography of where we grow our food changing dramatically. That has to happen in the United States, but I don't see, and maybe I'm still naive about this, but I don't see, you know, famine on the horizon for the United States or our diminished ability to feed Americans in the context of those changes. Some of the most interesting data that I collected for this reporting looks at declining crop yields across the country. The picture is striking. You know, it projects, well, it looks at corn and soy as proxies for, you know, for agriculture. So it excludes vegetables for a moment, but it projects declining crop yields of, you know, 40 to 50% across the Great Plains and our heartland, and up to total crop loss, 90%, even 100% in the deep south and parts of Texas. And that alone suggests that, you know, where we grow these staple crops, these big industrial crops, will have to change or the output will change. And then, you know, related but separate to that is where we do grow our fruits and vegetables. And, you know, you mentioned this a couple times as, you know, one of those signals that makes it hard to see that there's change happening. And I think that, you know, that it can make the country a little bit complacent to think that, you know, in February in New Jersey, you can always get fresh carrots grown in the Imperial Valley of, you know, of Southern California. But the Imperial Valley is one of those places that is, you know, is overusing a water supply from the Colorado River that is fast diminishing and that is oversubscribed, and the patterns there have to change. And short-term changes will mean, you know, that they stop growing things like alfalfa, which uses an incredible amount of water and is used to feed cattle. That might free up more water to keep growing those, you know, those winter vegetables and fruits, but long-term, it might not. And so yeah, there's a conversation, you know, beginning about, you know, what does that mean? Does it mean you pipe more water to that place because you have the agricultural infrastructure to continue growing food, or do you change where you grow food? Do we have a future where instead of industrial agriculture, you know, people grow their vegetables in their own backyards, and that so much of that might happen in the upper Midwest? So we might see those dramatic shifts.
I don't know what it is, but as you describe this, my mind is like imagining having to create new crop fields in Canada. If the trend is northward, do we have to keep growing northward, which there may not be fields up there? I don't know. The whole thing seems to me quite kind of perplexing and a little bit dire on that front.
It's both dire and full of opportunity. You know, land prices over the last couple of years have skyrocketed in places like Wisconsin, in northern Michigan, and even, you know, North Dakota. And you know, part of that speculative you know, boom, I believe, is because there, you know, there's industry and there's companies that are looking at the long-term viability of those lands, you know, as new growing regions. You see investors like Bill Gates, now one of the largest landholders in the United States, you know, buying heavily in Michigan. And you see the potential for crop yields. You know, my maps I was describing show declining crop yields across so much of the country, but they show increasing crop yields in those northern places, in places like Idaho, you know, that might have a longer growing season and more moisture in the future than they do today. So, you know, change can be disruptive and difficult. And again, we don't have necessarily shipping lines and trucking routes and infrastructure connected to those regions for farming, but you know, it could have great potential for moving agriculture northward.
Well, it is interesting to think about these northerly cities in America. I don't know. I think of like Buffalo or Rochester or places like way up north in Minnesota or Michigan that, you know, haven't gotten a lot of attention. Maybe some of them were more robust in different periods of industrial times. But I know that you've said that those might end up becoming these kind of hotspots in 50 to 100 years, and that there might be, you know, new life pumped into these cities that I think we have kind of forgotten about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the data points to the Great Lakes as one, you know, real promising region in the future. Not that the Great Lakes region won't, you know, suffer various, you know, climate impacts, but relatively speaking, it's very promising, in part because those lakes hold about 20% of the world's, you know, surface freshwater supply. And all the opportunity that goes along with that, you know, is kind of clear. The cities of the Rust Belt, you know, peaked in their population around, you know, the 70s, early 1970s. And, you know, in theory, at least, you know, many of them have what a lot of the planners I spoke with describe as excess capacity. They have housing stock or the land to build that housing that's already sort of zoned and apportioned for that urbanized use. They have, you know, highways and, you know, and that kind of capacity, and maybe infrastructure, which might need updating, but things like, you know, sewage treatment, water treatment plants, and all of those things that suggest that they can take, you know, absorb people. Cities like Buffalo are already marketing themselves as you know, climate havens for the future. I'm not sure they've taken a lot of concrete steps to turn that into reality, but, you know, but they're thinking about it that way, and they send out press releases about it. And, you know, so it's on the minds. This is kind of, you know, nascent thinking, I think, across that region.
Well, finally, I just want to return to really what is at the heart of this book, which is an incredible amount of data and an analysis and projections. Can you just tell us where that data initially came from, and how long did it take to really collate and paint the picture that you're painting now for us?
Yeah, thanks. So, you know, the book tries to provide some information for everybody by breaking down, you know, the data on a county by county basis across the country. So in a way, it's sort of a guidebook. You can pick it up and, you know, and find your spot and think about what's happening, you know, in your home and in your lives. And I collected a lot of this data from the Rhodium Group, the environmental and economic research firm that's known for doing some of the best analysis around both climate and economic changes. And it was given to me with some caveats. And those caveats are, you know, that you can't project migration that results from them, but each of the data sets that we worked with are empirically connected with driving migration. That's to say that, like, they're pretty conservative data sets. And they, you know, they are connected with, you know, with displacing people. And so we looked at wildfires on, you know, on the coasts, on both, you know, the West Coast, not surprisingly, but also, you know, in the southeastern United States, where wildfires are expected to grow larger and be increasingly common. We looked at water scarcity and declining crop yields and rising sea levels along the coasts and rising extreme humidity, which is going to creep up, you know, through the middle parts of the country along the Mississippi River basin and can make going outside or working outside, you know, quite dangerous and laborious. And we just looked at rising heat, and we mapped all of those things on a county basis, on a county by county basis across the country, and then looked at how those maps overlap to get a sense of, you know, where the risks are compounding and overlapping, and the general direction of you know, of quote unquote safety. And it's an interesting and a different picture, because some of the, you know, past climate migration modeling uses things like U.S. Census data, and that census data says that people historically from Florida have moved to Arizona or have moved to Austin, Texas. And some of the climate migration research suggests that those will be the patterns of the future. But when you map the kind of data that I've mapped, you see that, you know, that Arizona and Austin, Texas have problems of their own. And so, you know, I think it presents a different hypothesis that people from Florida will no longer be able to move to places like Arizona, and they're much more likely to move to places like Atlanta or Michigan.
Well, it's been a fascinating conversation with Abram Lustgarten, investigative journalist and the author of On the Move, The Overheating Earth and the Uprooting of America. Abram, thanks so much for the time. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for the conversation. I've enjoyed it.
Still to come, from climate scientist to climate activist, the story of Rose Abramoff. That's next on KCRW's Life Examined. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Jonathan Bastian, back with Life Examined on KCRW. We just heard Abram Lustgarten talk about the next great historical migration, the impacts of climate change on U.S. cities, and the necessity to move northwards to cooler, wetter regions like the Great Lakes. Much of Lustgarten's book, On the Move, includes data collected and researched by ecologists, geologists, and climate scientists. Like many of those scientists, Rose Abramoff also built her career around earth sciences and ecology. Abramoff worked at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Tennessee, spending a good deal of time out in the field, witnessing and noticing the changes in real time. The question she asked herself, how could she remain silent and impartial? What could she do to sound the alarm? In a recent New York Times op-ed called, "I'm a Scientist Who Spoke Up About Climate Change. My Employer Fired Me," Abramoff explains her difficult and scary decision. Rose Abramoff, welcome to Life Examined.
Thanks for having me.
I mean, give us a sense of what it was like for you to cross over from the world of you know, the scientist to the world of activism. Can you talk about that threshold? Because I think it's a really important one.
Yeah, it's an important threshold. And it's interesting because when I talk to my fellow colleagues, it's one of the first and most important things that they bring up is this idea that scientists are supposed to be policy neutral, or that science has nothing to do with politics. And I think that in many ways, it's a very manufactured threshold. Because, you know, I started thinking about this when I was, you know, joining like the Women in Science Empowerment Committee, and the sort of like diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives made me think, well, you know, obviously we have values, right? We have values around who we hire, how we do hiring, how we treat each other. And those are not apolitical. There are political and social and cultural dimensions to that. And I also think that what we choose to study is very related to politics, right? Like, we didn't go to the moon because we were just purely interested in seeing what was on the moon. I mean, that was part of it, but part of it was also to establish geopolitical dominance over Russia, right?
So,
the science that we do, how that science is funded, who makes those decisions is deeply ingrained with like our values as a society and political values. And so I think it's a little bit naive of us to say, oh, well, we're completely divorced from that. We are just searching for truth. And we're interested in understanding what happens to the climate and don't have any stake in that as humans or as organisms that live on Earth and require the Earth's services to stay alive.
No, I just want to say, I think that's really important and interesting, because I think we live our lives one way or another as political creatures, even if we don't think about it as political. What we do, how we spend our time, the things we buy, the way we vote, all of this stuff, which any scientist is entitled to do. But it is kind of odd to think that when it comes to their work, there can actually be something like apoliticalness or something, right? There does seem to be something that doesn't quite match up there.
Yeah, I've thought a lot about why that culture exists. And I really think it has to do with this sort of like history of Western philosophy and this paradigm of like man's dominance over nature and this idea that we are separate from nature and that we do our best work when we are, you know, studying something that we feel separated from, right? This idea of like, we don't want to interact with or bias or feel that we are part of the system that we're studying, this sense of separation between humans and nature, is a very kind of constructed Western idea. Like a lot of, you know, indigenous citizens, scientists and activists and, you know, researchers don't necessarily think that way, right? Like they think there's like a more, you know, Robin Wall Kimmerer in her book, Braiding Sweetgrass, lays out this whole perspective of doing science from the perspective of being part of nature, part of the system that you're studying, and, you know, that there can be some really deep insights that come from not cutting humans out of the experiment, for example.
Right. Totally. Yeah. Well, this is where I get to plug and say Robin Wall Kimmerer was on our show and talked about just this. So we hope that anybody will go listen to that if they'd like. But bring us then into, if there was like a tipping point for you, was it a certain amount of data? Was it something churning inside of you that thought like, maybe my life is going to take a different direction?
I think it really was just an accumulation of like small tragedies that I witnessed happening in nature. So I'm an ecologist by training. I study how climate change and land use change affect plants and soil. And so I used to do quite a lot more field work. Like I did my doctorate thesis in this eastern forest, looking at the timing of when roots grow versus leaves in these different forest stands. And one of those forest stands was the eastern hemlock, which is a coniferous tree, very ubiquitous across the eastern U.S., Tsuga canadensis. And at the time, it was in that stand that I was studying was in the early stages of an infection by an invasive pest called the hemlock woolly adelgid. It's like a little aphid-like insect. And the woolly adelgid's range was expanding northward because of climate change. It's often killed off by extremely cold winter temperatures. And as winter's warm, the temperatures don't get cold enough to kill them off. They can overwinter and their populations explode. And they're fatal to the stands that they infect more often than not. And so, and I was watching that and measuring it, you know, you could see, we had these little tubes, these like polyurethane plastic tubes essentially installed in the ground, and we would stick a camera down that tube so we could look around in the soil. And you could see roots growing, you could see earthworms crawling around, you could see like the hyphae, the little single cellular arms of symbiotic fungi, you know, crawling across this glass of this plastic. And you could see that those, you know, I could see roots dying in that stand relative to the other healthier stands that I was studying. And it was heartbreaking, you know, and it wasn't the graph. Like I've seen tons of graphs. I've read tons of papers in the IPCC report. It still chokes me up because you spend enough hours in a place and it starts to feel like part of your home, right? Like you develop a connection to those organisms. And to watch them die is heartbreaking.
Yeah, I mean, I can hear just kind of what a connection you felt to that place. And, you know, for us, we may not, you know, have the experience of seeing something we love that concretely, studying it for that long, kind of die in front of us. I mean, how did that feel just watching that over and over again?
It was really difficult. You know, I remember later, you know, some years later, I was doing a postdoc in California, and they had an experiment going, a warming experiment in the Arctic tundra in Utqiagvik, the northernmost city in the U.S. And you could sort of feel it's permafrost up there. The soil is, some amount of that soil is supposed to be frozen year round. And you could sort of feel it melting in the summertime under your feet. And you could see the slumps, you know, of areas which used to be frozen, which had melted and had collapsed because the ice, ice has a larger volume than water. And so when ice melts, it collapses the landscape. And it's really hard to watch. And those most visceral experiences for me are always to do with field work. I mean, I feel like I've seen much more heartbreaking graphs, right? To do with extreme heat, projections across the whole of India, or right? Like things that have implications for billions of people, everyone on Earth.
Yeah, totally.
And I have less of an emotional reaction to that because that there's that separation, right? And I think this is one of the central issues communicating the sort of urgency and severity of this crisis is that when you put it in a very boring looking line graph, you know, and in the sort of using the scientific jargon that's common to our work, it's, you don't feel that, you don't feel what it means. The meaning is lost, even though we're reporting exactly what it is, right? The projections are accurate. The graph is heavily researched.
But
you don't feel what it means, what its implications are.
Yeah. And I think that's really what I'm sensing from you is what it was like for you to be face to face with these experiences of seeing things die, of seeing the world change. And I guess just to explore that a little bit more, I mean, do you feel like that is just fundamental for us to really understand how the world is changing? Do we need to be face to face? Do we need to feel things on a deeper level, I think, to have this stuff sink in?
I do think that it would be helpful for us to feel both more connected to nature and more connected to each other, and sort of exercise that empathy muscle. Because I think feeling detached, whether it's intentional or not intentional, leads to us making decisions that don't care for or recognize all the interconnections that keep us alive and happy and joyful. I do think that paradigm shift, whatever it is probably necessary.
So then what did it feel like identity-wise or career-wise or whatever, all the different parts of you when, you know, you took on the title of activist suddenly? Like, what did that do to you?
It's interesting because I remember the scariest moment. People always tell me, oh, you know, you must be so brave because you've been arrested, you know, 7 times or whatever.
Wow, have you been arrested 7 times?
I have. I was like counting them up in my head.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, 7 times as of this recording. In various, you know, in climate justice, environmental justice actions, right, campaigns. And of course those were nerve-wracking, but I actually felt quite well prepared for those. You know, we have legal briefings and nonviolence trainings. There's a huge community of support to sort of like help you understand how to do these things in a safer way. Mm-hmm. And so what I found the scariest about the transition from scientist to activist was just the moment when I was sitting in my at home, you know, staring at the wall, and I decided that I was going to say my first public political thing, that I was going to identify as an activist. Like, I hadn't even done anything yet. And it was really just deciding to, I think it was like, you know, my first political tweet or something. Like,
yeah, and totally.
And which is essentially meaningless. Like, it has very little capacity to make change or mobilize anyone. And it has, you know, no consequences. But that shift in identity was so, you know, like, scientists' identities are often so important because it takes so many years of hard work, right, to like gather the degrees that you need to call yourself a scientist.
So the PhD, I mean, it's just like, it's like a long, long process to get even, you know, those letters after your name.
Exactly. And so we can really cling to that sort of like, that's right, what I am, and this is what a scientist is supposed to do. And so just deciding before I even did anything remotely spicy, just to change that identity was the scariest, was to this day, like the most frightening choice.
Can you talk about ways that you have felt your activism, hopefully, has felt important or tries to move the needle? Like, what kind of actions have you taken that you feel are important?
Yeah. Well, I firstly think that it's really important for scientists and researchers to engage with the climate crisis in the political realm. You know, I know everyone is busy and we're already doing very important work, but I think of us a little bit as the, you know, firefighters coming to the burning house. If we don't act like it's an emergency, if we don't sort of demonstrate what that looks like, you know, there's no reason for anyone else to worry, right? And so I do think it behooves us to sort of show, to sort of demonstrate an emergency response rather than just say, oh, we need an emergency response. You know, if a firefighter comes to your house and says, we should really put this fire out, and then sits down and has a cup of tea, like, it's just not as compelling. And so I do think there is a lot of power in, you know, climate scientists, earth scientists, researchers more broadly, people with an understanding of what's going on, to really use that credibility and that privilege, really. Like, there is a power in that, right? There's a power in the education that we have, and we can use that power to mobilize people. What that looks like is, you know, when we join actions, I work most often with this group called Scientist Rebellion, and we partner with a lot of different activist groups. And when we show up to actions, we always get more media attention because, you know, I mean, you're talking to me, right? I'm sure you talk to activists as well. but it is just inherently true that someone who has accumulated quite a lot of credentials, you know, is more interesting to the media to talk to. And we've often already had some training in science communication that's very transferable. So, you know, we're often accidentally reasonably good writers, right? It just gives us a little bit more kind of entree into that world. Sometimes we already have interacted with policymakers and have greater access to them. Like, there's just access that comes with having a bunch of degrees. It's a type of power.
What about, though, ways of being an activist? I mean, as we're having this conversation, college campuses are having these incredible demonstrations, you know, of tent cities that are being erected in the middle of quads. And what's it like for you to watch that? I mean, not to mention the Black Lives Matter movement, so many others, but for you to look at those things and then think, should we be doing that? Do I think that's effective? Do we need to be more aggressive, whatever that word means or you want to define it? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think that we need a mass movement. And I think that history has demonstrated that mass, nonviolent, primarily movements. I would advocate for nonviolence personally. But, you know, there are other effective types of movements that exist. But one that involves a lot of people can be really effective. And it's not just that we need to get enough people on a lawn to convince, you know, people in power to change their ways or to change policy or fossil fuel executives to make different decisions. We really have to get in their way. And that's one of the reasons why nonviolent disruptive activism is what it is, right? There are things like giant tent cities, blockades. You know, in New York, there's a campaign that's been targeting Citibank where they just sort of get in front of the headquarters and hold hands with each other, right? And block people from literally entering that building to do business. And I think that, you know, there are ways to do those sorts of design those sorts of actions so that they're really focused, they're targeting elites, and they're bringing the types of businesses that need to change to a grinding halt. You know, that's one of the things that was so effective about the civil rights movement is, you know, there was this public movement that changed the narrative and changed public sentiment, but they really kind of shut businesses down with their sit-ins, and affecting elites in that way. You know, some recent scholarship showing that was one of the things that really kind of turned the needle and moved the needle and really accelerated that political change.
What I see is somebody who's part of the media but has friends that are, you know, do the type of work that you've been talking about is, like, you know, an academic will compile so much data and then publish it in some place that's relatively big, like Nature or Science, but here's the deal. Nobody actually reads those things outside of universities, you know? Like, they don't seem to me to, like, have a big cultural impact. And there's this missing link between what I do and what academics do, which is some form of storytelling, which you're talking about, right? And it's like, we don't seem to know how to get that data out in ways that feel effective or that hits home or is emotional. And I think that's a major challenge we have right now.
And I also think maybe one of the, you know, I think everyone recognizes that we could be doing a better job at translating data in effective ways. But one of the even bigger missing pieces to me is sort of the next step of that. So what do we do with this information, right?
Yeah.
Because to me, it's not just like I feel like part of the reason why we're unwilling to recognize the climate crisis as the level of a crisis as it is that we do recognize it, and we don't know what to do with that level of information. And so like telling stories about potential futures, you know, about like what the future could look like if we made different decisions, is to me like what is most missing. And of course there are a lot of people who are already doing that, but it's harder work, right? Because you really have to like imagine different ways of doing almost everything that we currently do, from eating to traveling to the like what we consider success in an economy, how we measure wealth, how we, you know, interact with each other, how we power our house, how we organize dwellings. Just everything could and probably needs to change. And so showing people what that could look like is an important step that I think we need to take, because it's not necessarily about a lack of information. That's sort of what I came to realize, is that I was generating all this information thinking, oh, if we just explain this to the right people, things will change. But the people in power have heard from us. So it's not about information, it's about power. And so in order to build collective power among us, among the people, we need to have enough of us unite around a shared vision of the future. And so that to me is like the next great challenge.
Well, Rose Abramoff, thanks for being on the program today. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Me too. Thank you so much.
And Rose Abramoff is the author of the New York Times op-ed, "I'm a Scientist Who Spoke About Climate Change, My Employer Fired Me." And that's it for this week. The producer of Life Examined is Andrea Brody. You can find a link to all of our archives at kcrw.com/lifeexamined, where you can also find a link to our Facebook page. We'd love to hear any climate-related stories from you. How do you see the climate changing on a day-to-day level? How do these stories of immigration impact you and your ideas about the future? Please chime in. You can also connect with me directly on Instagram. I'm at Jonathan W. Bastian. Ask me any questions. Tell me what you'd like to hear on the show. Once again, you've been listening to KCRW's Life Examined. I'm your host, Jonathan Bastian. Check out the Midweek Reset every Wednesday in your podcast feed. Take care, and we'll see you soon.